Welcome to a Juno Afternoon here on Tuesday, June 10th, 2014. I'm your Tuesday guy, Scott Burton. Today on the show, it's a good one. We'll hear from Ryan Jones and about his book and presentation, Empire of Extinction, on Thursday. Catherine Kell will be here to tell us about new programs at the campus. Jason Donig, entrepreneur, artist, fisherman, and carpenter, Jason Donig, will be here to tell us about his new business, Alaska Reuse in Lemon Creek. We'll catch up with actor Ryan Conroe and hear about his upcoming projects and also his travels to New York and Abu Dhabi. And Amy O'Neill Houck will be here to tell us about the Juno Fine Arts Camp. Those guests, Bird Note, Writer's Almanac, music, and more right here on a Juno Afternoon. Here's National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Sarah Gustavus. The Mid-Year Conference for the National Congress of American Indians, or NCAI, is underway this week in Anchorage, Alaska. Many items are on the agenda, and each connects individuals and tribes to broader national concerns. NCAI Executive Director Jacqueline Peta was one of many leaders who addressed the General Assembly on Monday.
Policy decisions made by lawmakers and agency officials affect Indian country as a whole. At the federal level, those impacts are felt positively and negatively by tribal governments, tribal communities, tribal families, and every individual Native person.
Kevin Washburn, Assistant Secretary for Indian Affairs in the U.S. Department of the Interior, spoke about bringing more land into trust. And Tony West, Associate Attorney General of the United States, told delegates that voting rights and access to the polls are crucial issues that his department is following. West mentioned one Alaska Native village that limited polling hours due to geography.
You see, the village is separated into two parts by a river, and there is no bridge. So on election day, an election official announces over Marine radio that anyone who wants to vote in one part of the village has to come down to a community center no later than 11:30 a.m. Because at 11:30 a.m., that official collects the election materials, packs up the single voting machine, drives it down to the river by four-wheeler, and loads it onto a boat to cross over to the other side.
U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder announced Monday that his office will propose a new requirement that local election officials work with tribes to designate at least one polling site chosen by leaders on reservations and in Alaska Native villages. Again, Tony West.
The right to vote, the right to choose who will speak and act in our names, the right to express our sovereignty over our government. A right that is, to paraphrase one American president, the foundation on which the Temple of Liberty is built, because it protects all other rights. That right, more than any other, is what defines us as joint and equal members of a democratic society.
NCAI attendees have the opportunity this week to discuss issues like health and wellness, water rights, and food security. Also in Anchorage, public meetings will be held for the Attorney General's Task Force on American Indian and Alaska Native Children Exposed to Violence, and the U.S. Department of Agriculture is opening up a meeting to discussions about how tribal leaders can engage in more meaningful dialogue with the federal agency. The NCAI conference wraps up on Wednesday. The Pueblo of Jemez announced this week that a group of World War II veterans will soon be recognized with honorary high school diplomas. In a press release, the tribe says 53 male members and two female members were called to duty during the war and were not able to complete their education. The veterans will be honored later this month. Jemez Pueblo officials say education is an important value for the tribe, and the event will bring together community members while recognizing the contributions of the veterans. During this month in 2007, Oklahoma tribal leaders watched President George W. Bush sign a bill in Washington, D.C. to reauthorize the Native American Home Ownership Opportunity Act. It encouraged home ownership among Native people by guaranteeing mortgages. This is National Native News. I'm Sarah Gustavus.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. Supported by Sacred Wind Community Connect, providing scholarships and internet training to the Navajo Nation and Pueblo of Laguna in New Mexico. Sacred Wind believes broadband can reinforce Native cultures and offer means for self-determination. SacredWindCommunications.com. With funding from ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
You're listening to a Juno Afternoon here on Tuesday, June 10th, 2014. It's about 6 minutes after the hour. With me on the telephone now, I believe he's in California, Mr. Ryan Jones. Ryan, how are you? Can you hear me? Oh, here it is. Ryan, can you hear me?
I can hear you.
There we go. I just put up the turntable knob and not the telephone knob.
All right.
So you're down in California right now, is that correct?
I am, yeah.
Okay. So Ryan, everybody, is going, Dr. Jones here, is going to be giving a presentation on his book, Empire of Extinction, Russians and the North Pacific Strange Beasts of the Sea from 1741 to 1867 on Thursday as part of the State Historical Library Summer Lecture Series. So we'll remind you of all that in a minute. But Ryan, could you start off by telling us a little bit about yourself? You teach at the University of Auckland, is that right?
Yeah, that's right. Actually, I'm just beginning a new job there this next month. So I moved down to New Zealand. I was teaching at Idaho State University in Pocatello, and excited to be much closer to the Pacific.
Okay. And you're originally from Portland, Oregon, right?
That's right. Yeah, I'm from Portland.
But you have friends and connections in Alaska. We were talking earlier about your interest in the North Pacific. How exactly did you get so interested in the North Pacific?
Well, I went to Alaska fairly frequently in high school and college. And then when I started training to become a professor, I really got interested in Russian history. Mm-hmm. And when I started off writing this book, I really thought of it as a history of the Russian Empire. I was really interested in that, but got into the archives in St. Petersburg and Siberia and then in Alaska, and over time really kind of changed to being much more a book about Alaska. And I kind of rediscovered some of my connections with the Pacific Northwest through this. I, for example, was up in the Aleutians and saw the places where both my grandfathers had served during the Second World War, and just really came to love Alaska as a state and love its history. And this book is, ironically, I had to go all the way to Russia to kind of reconnect with my Pacific Northwest roots, and really glad that I've done it. Made some incredible friends in Alaska on the way.
Well, it sounds like you've had a lot of fun producing this book.
Oh, absolutely. It's been great. It's taken a while. I'm really glad it's finally out, and I'm really glad I get to talk about it in Alaska.
Yeah, 320-page hardcover. I suspect it was a lot of research.
It seems like it, yeah.
So for our listeners who haven't seen some of the stuff that I've seen, can you give us a brief synopsis of what it's about?
Yeah, so what I look at in this book is, first of all, the way that Russians dealt with the environment in Alaska. And I think everyone's probably pretty familiar with some of the horrible things that they did, exterminating Steller sea cow, nearly killing off sea otters in Alaskan waters. And then I talk about the ways that the Russians came to regret having done this. They came to understand in new ways what they were doing to this colonial environment and tried at least to start to figure out some ways to fix these problems. Kind of a story that I didn't even expect when I started researching this book.
Yeah, that's a new perspective. I haven't heard of that either. And so who are some of the characters in this book that you talk about? Who were some of these folks that became interested in the environment?
Right. Well, I primarily focus on scientists or natural historians, as they were called. Wanted to understand how these people had looked at the environment, maybe how they'd been able to influence Russian policy. And you know, what I found was these guys probably familiar with some of the names, Steller, Langsdorff, a lot of these great scientific explorers of Alaska. What I found is that they were first totally gung-ho about essentially killing as many sea otters as the Russians could and shipping them off to China. But around the 1780s, they realized that there was crisis unfolding, and a crisis which they really hadn't seen anywhere else in the world, and that was that species were actually going extinct, and it really shook them up. And they publicized this, really embarrassed the Russian Empire, and pushed it to change its attitude.
Okay. As you researched and wrote this book, what surprised you most in that process?
A couple things surprised me. I mean, first of all, the fact that Russians really did manage to stem the tide of extinction by around the 1820s or 1830s, and actually by the 1850s, they had become really proud of their conservation record, kind of uniquely in the colonial world at the time. So that was one thing. And another thing, I guess, was how much some Russians just really came to love Alaska. There's stunningly beautiful descriptions of the Aleutian Islands, for example, and certainly southeastern Alaska, and some of these naturalist journals. They were really deeply impacted by the people there and by the landscapes they were looking at, and that was really touching.
I see. Ryan, how would you describe the writing in the book? Does it read like a textbook? Are you present as a narrator?
Briefly, okay. Make an appearance in the introduction. No, it's certainly an academic book. I tried to make it as fun and readable as possible, or as fun as it can be about reading about the deaths of thousands and thousands of animals.
Right.
But it's not difficult to understand, I don't think. Lay it out in a pretty straightforward manner. Oh, it's not a page-turner, but I think it's an interesting story. I think if you're interested in the deeper history of the Alaskan environment, there'll be a lot there to interest you.
Okay. And so you will be giving a presentation on Thursday here at the State Historical Library, which for our listeners, the 8th floor of the SOB is part of the summer lecture series. It's at noon on Thursday. Ryan, what can we expect as part of the presentation?
Some great pictures I've gotten from my book, and a lot more detail about what I've said here, introduce you to a few of the colorful characters involved in the story, and explain some of the real unlikely ways that this story came about.
Well, it sounds like fun. I suspect it's going to be well attended there. A lot of people interested in this. So I suspect you'll have a great crowd and lots of good questions, and it sounds like a lot of fun.
I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, Ryan, is there anything else that you'd like to add?
No, not right now. Just come out on Thursday. I look forward to having conversation with people. This has been one of the most rewarding parts of writing a book about Alaska, is the many conversations I've had with people who care deeply about the state, care about the ocean.
Great, Ryan. Well, thanks for your time, and we look forward to having you up here on Thursday.
Great. Hope to see you then.
Okay, see you later.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
This is Bird Note. Laying and incubating eggs is serious business for wild birds. Some birds, such as swifts and albatrosses, lay only one egg. For ducks and quail, 10 to 12 isn't uncommon. The female of these species lays one egg per day, until the clutch is complete. And the parents wait for at least half of the clutch to be laid before they begin incubating. That's so all the eggs will hatch about the same time, a process that can take as few as 11 days to as many as 11 weeks. Ducklings, goslings, and other waterfowl spend up to 30 days in the egg, so they're able to walk, swim, and feed themselves as soon as they hatch. We call these chicks precocial, because they seem to be mature beyond their age, like precocious children. By contrast, the chicks of pigeons, robins, and most songbirds spend less time, perhaps only 2 weeks, maturing in the egg. They hatch blind, naked, and helpless, and must continue to develop in the nest before heading out on their own. We call these hatchlings altricial, needing to be nourished, since they depend upon their parents to feed and protect them. For Bird Note, I'm Mary McCann. Precocial or altricial? What were you?
It's 15 minutes after the hour here on Tuesday, June 10th, 2014, and I've been joined in the studio by the Canvas's Catherine Kell. How are you today?
Fine, thank you. How about yourself?
I'm good. So, let's see, the last time I saw you, we were talking about the Block Party Street Fair.
Yeah.
How'd that go?
Oh, it went really well. We had a great turnout. Weather held out for most of it, and everyone seemed to have a really good time.
What was the highlight for you?
I think the highlight would have to be, personally for me, was the Silly Olympics.
Mm-hmm.
There's just something about watching people try to run down the street while holding a banana between their knees that just, it's a good time for everyone involved.
That does sound like fun. And speaking of fun, you have some cool stuff coming up at the Canvas. You want to tell us about it?
Yeah. Mainly we have a class called Sounds of the Capital City, which we've created as an opportunity for people to learn more about the music and musicians behind upcoming performances.
Great idea.
Yeah. This round we're going to be featuring the Juno Symphony. And specifically this Friday from noon to 1, the concert pianist who's going to be performing with the symphony, Tanya Gabrielian, is going to be providing an interactive, like, lunchtime seminar on the relationship between the visual arts and music.
Interesting. Wow.
Yeah.
Visual arts and music.
Mm-hmm.
Huh. I wonder what she's going to talk about.
I'm not entirely sure on all the details, but I know it's going to be involving a bunch of different types of multimedia. There's going to be video clips. She's going to show examples of visual artwork that has directly inspired musical compositions.
Oh, fun.
She's also going to be playing music from the upcoming concert over our speaker system and giving people the opportunity to create a painting or a drawing based on what they kind of see while listening to the music.
That sounds great.
Yeah.
And that's Friday from noon to 1?
Noon to 1, and it's free.
Awesome.
Mm-hmm. And then the second part of the class, that next day on Saturday, 11 a.m. to 2 p.m., we have the Juno Symphony dress rehearsal over at JDHS. And basically the symphony's been gracious enough to open it up and let people come in and watch a symphony in action.
Mm-hmm.
And if they stick around afterwards, they'll get a chance to meet our current conductor, Kyle Pickett.
Yeah, before he takes off.
Mm-hmm. Yep, this is his farewell concert.
Wow. And so that's on Saturday at the high school.
Mm-hmm.
From 11 to 2?
Yes.
Okay. And the one on Friday, that's at the Canvas, right?
Yes, it's going to be at the Canvas Gallery. So if you work downtown, you know, you have your lunch hour, 12 to 1, come on down the Canvas, learn some stuff about music and about art.
Wow, that sounds like a lot of fun. I hope to see you there.
All right.
Well, Catherine, is there anything else that you'd like to add? Any other things you want to tell us about at the Canvas?
Nope. We've always got a lot going on. We got our kids' classes going on.
All are busy. I was looking at your website. Lots of stuff. That's great.
Yep. So.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for your time, Catherine.
All right. Thank you.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday, the 10th of June, 2014. It's the birthday of Saul Bellow, born in Lachine, Quebec, 1913, parents immigrants from Russia. His father worked in a bakery. He delivered coal. He was a bootlegger as well. When Saul was 9 years old, the family moved to Chicago, which would become the setting of many of Bellow's novels. He went to Northwestern, studied anthropology and sociology, went to work for the Chicago branch of the WPA Writers Project. He was working on a novel called Reuben Whitfield, ended up abandoning that, wrote a second novel, The Very Dark Trees, in 1942. He was working part-time for the Encyclopedia Britannica when his first novel came out in 1944, Dangling Man, which got good reviews. He went off, he served in the Marines, published a second novel, got a Guggenheim, moved to Paris, wrote the book that would make him famous, The Adventures of Augie March, 1953. He started writing the book in Paris, but Bellow said it was Chicago before the Depression that moved my imagination, not misty Paris with its cold statues and its streams of water running along the curbstones. Augie March begins, "I'm an American, Chicago born, Chicago, that somber city, and go at things as I have taught myself, freestyle, and will make the record in my own way. First to knock, first admitted, sometimes an innocent knock, sometimes a not so innocent, but a man's character is his fate," says Heraclitus, "and in the end, there isn't any way to disguise the nature of the knocks by acoustical work on the door or gloving the knuckles." It was on this day, 1881, Leo Tolstoy, at the age of 52, having written his two great novels, War and Peace and Anna Karenina, set off on a pilgrimage to the Optinopustin Monastery. He was famous, he was wealthy, had a big family, land, money. It all seemed empty to him. He had trouble sleeping, unable to write, contemplated suicide. So he took a walk in the woods, and he found God. He wrote, "At the thought of God, happy waves of life welled up inside me. Everything came alive, took on meaning." He renounced meat, sex, alcohol, fiction, tobacco, dressed like a peasant, wanted to give all of his money away, which made his wife Sophia very unhappy. Here's a poem for today by Carrie Fountain entitled Progress. When they paved the streets of Massilla, they dug a trench in front of our house, 4 feet wide, 3 feet deep, where the sidewalk would eventually go, and my father laid a steel plate across it so he could pull his car into the drive, come and go, which is what he did. And my brother spent the rest of that summer in the trench, under the plate, alone down there in the silt and shade, finding out what he was. I'd sit on the porch, pretending to read a book, while I watched those men from the city in their plain blue shirts or not, the knuckles of their work gloves thickly clotted with tar. They returned every morning, clean as the sun, with their bent black shovels and that drum of weeping tar. Every day they made a little progress. We were really getting somewhere. A road is the crudest faith in things to come. Progress, a poem by Carrie Fountain from her collection Burn Lake, published by Penguin and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by Lumosity.com, a brain training program designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 50 million people worldwide. More at Lumosity.com. Produced by Joy Biles, with assistance by Teresa Burgess. Be well, do good work, keep in touch.
...360 North and KTOO want to let you know about our new multimedia project, A Roof, a year-long look at housing and homelessness in Alaska. We'll look at trends, costs, and solutions to the state's housing and homelessness issues. The idea behind A Roof is that everyone deserves a roof over their head. Check out our project at 360north.org and tweet us ideas with the hashtag AKRoof. A Roof, a new multimedia project from 360 North and KTOO.
It's 25 minutes after the hour here on Tuesday, June 10th, 2014. Scott Burton here, your Tuesday host, and I've been joined in the studio by my great friend, Mr. Jason Donig. Jason, how are you today?
I'm doing real good, thanks, Scott.
Good. And among other things, you're a photographer, one of my favorite photographers in Alaska, but we won't talk about that today. Fisherman, carpenter, jack of all trades, but right now we're here to talk about your new business, AK Reuse, out in Lemon Creek.
Yes, sir.
So tell us a little bit about what AK Reuse is. What does it do?
AK Reuse, what does it do? It is a reuse building material store. So if I have a lot of material that's been donated to me or given to me, and I will resell it to the public at 50% off the price of new. Basically, same as a reuse store down south. They're all over the place.
Yeah, it's a great new thing that's going on. Tell us about some of the stuff that you have there right now as an example so people can visualize.
As an example, nuts, bolts, doors, toilets.
Lots of doors, windows.
Lots of doors.
Lots of doors, windows.
Lights.
Bathtubs.
Bathtubs, brackets.
Big beams.
Big beams.
Pipe.
Pipe, wire. Pretty much anything to do with building material. Kitchen cabinets, but not tables and not furniture.
Okay. So, Jay, I know that you work as a carpenter as well. What inspired you to open this store, I guess this your yard, AK Reuse?
I've been in the carpentry trade for a long time, and I really enjoy it. It's always nice, something new every day, but I've never really been too passionate about it, and I just got tired of all the waste and seeing everything just going to the dump.
Ones, right?
And it was really hard to deal with, and then the idea came up to do something like this.
I remember you telling me about that scene, lots of really good stuff going to the dump, and you had nowhere to put it. You didn't have a space to store it. You knew it was good material, but it just had to go.
Yeah, it's really tough, especially in this climate.
Especially when your boss is telling you to do it, right, and you don't have time to do something with it. So that gave you the inspiration to open AK Reuse. Tell us a little bit about the history. When did you get the space, and when did you start putting it together?
About two or three years ago, I sat down with a business consultant, and we hatched together a plan. And then about two winters ago, I wrote a business plan, which was painstaking and long, and why am I doing this? But I think it was a good thing, because I refer to it quite a bit. And then I started renting a space last April, and here we are, June something. I'm ready to go.
All right. And speaking of the space, it's in Lemon Creek. It's by the brewery. It's by the brewery. It's by the dump. It's by Home Depot. It's by Costco. But I guess the best part of that, well, besides the brewery, is that it's by the dump. So you can, if you're going to the dump, people can come by and see you.
So people can come by and say, this is what I have, and I have to be very picky in what I take. Because I was even being picky over the winter, and I still had to throw away a bunch of stuff. But, yeah, just stop in before you go to the dump and save a little bit of money and do something good for the environment.
So, let's see, to be even more specific on how to get there, go past the brewery, and what's that road called?
It's called Shawn Drive. It's 5327 Shawn Drive, and it's just past Silverbow Construction. There'll be a sign on the street, a little sandwich board sign, and it's right across
good-looking
the street.
Sign.
Good-looking sign. Thank you, Scott, for helping me on that. And it's right across the street from a storage units that are going up, so it's pretty obvious where it is.
Okay, and you're going to have a grand opening this Saturday from 10 to 5. Is
yes,
that correct?
That is correct.
Okay. Have you thought about what your hours are going to be after that?
I'm thinking probably Friday, Saturday, Sunday. Friday 10 to 6, Saturday 9 to 5, and Sunday 10 to 5.
Okay.
Just to see how it goes, and I can keep working and just not rely on the company at first.
So weekends only, pretty much including Friday and weekends. So that's when, if people have materials, that's when they should bring them by.
Well, yes. For now, that is when, but okay. I think I'm going to try. I'm just going to see how it all goes, but I'm probably going to try to have a few afternoons during the week. But again, just going to see how it goes.
Okay. And I know you have a Facebook page for it. So it's AK Reuse, R-E-U-S-E. And you have a website, too, that you're building, right?
Yes.
Okay.
And then if anybody wants to get a hold of me at akreuse@gmail, too.
Okay. akreuse@gmail. And you have a phone number, 586- 5025.
Yep, and all I have to do is get a phone, and that'll be up and running.
Sounds good. Jay, what's been the best part of, I know it's been really hard. You've been working a lot and jumping through a lot of hoops and getting stuff going, business plans and all that stuff. I suspect that's probably the most challenging part. What's been the most fulfilling part for you?
It has gone beyond anything I had expected, or I had a lot of visions for what this was going to be, including sitting here with Mr. Burton talking on the radio.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just it being there and being at the yard. The potentials are endless, and it's a good thing.
It is a good thing, and it's a great thing for the community.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely, you know, keeping stuff out of the dump, that's a good thing, and reusing cool old stuff. I mean, some of the materials you have down there, some of those old doors are just absolutely gorgeous. Old glass doorknobs, beautiful light fixtures. Where did you get all that stuff?
So last summer, I thought I was going to open, and so I went to Seattle to sort of give me a little kick in the butt, mm-hmm. if that's okay to say.
Sure.
So I went down there and got a bunch of material from a vintage architectural used store down there called Earthwise, and just been sitting on it for the whole winter. So there's still a lot of goodies out there, and I hope to see what the public wants and hopefully get back down there and get some more unique stuff you can't get anywhere else.
Okay. And for folks here in Juneau, if you have some cool stuff sitting around your house and it's not going to use, they can bring it down to you, right, Jay?
Yeah, I guess I'm sort of the whole business concept is the public. Without the public and without extra old things they have lying around their house, I don't have a business. So if you're tired of having all those drawers full of nuts and bolts and wires that you're never going to use, stop by and see if I'll take them and free up your cupboard space.
Well, Jay, it's a great idea. Thank you for opening this business. Juneau absolutely needed one. I mean, they are swinging down south all over the place, Seattle, Portland. All these cities have these reuse stores, mm-hmm. and they're keeping stuff out of the dumps and, again, reusing old, cool stuff. And now you've brought that to Juneau, so thank you very much for doing that.
You're welcome.
And big shout-out to Juneauites. Let's support this great new business. Check them out, AK Reuse. It's out there by the brewery, Costco, Home Depot. Just make a big loop, the dump. Go check it all out. Jay, is there anything else you want to add?
I'm all good. I'm excited to get this thing rolling, and hopefully see you out there.
Cool, Jay. Thanks for your time.
Thank you, Scott.
The thought of my sons growing up without me inspired me to quit smoking.
I talked to my doctors, and then I threw away all my cigarettes, ashtrays, and lighters.
I started exercising instead of smoking.
Staying away from alcohol when I was first quitting was key.
I kept on trying, learned something each time.
Do whatever it takes.
No matter how many times it takes.
We did it, so can you.
You can quit. We can help. Call Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line, 1-800-QUIT-NOW.
It is about 37 minutes and 10 seconds after the hour here on Tuesday, June 10th, 2014. And with me in the studio now is Amy O'Neill Hauck. Amy, how are you today?
Fine, thanks. Thanks for having me.
Yeah,
Scott.
Thanks for coming down. So you're here to tell us about the Juno Fine Arts Camp.
Yeah, that's right. We're in the beginning of our second week of camp, and we've got over 150 excited children learning about all sorts of art, and I wanted to come in to let people know that there's still room in weeks 3 and 4.
Cool, cool. So tell us a little bit, the camp's at JDHS, is that
yeah,
right?
Yeah, it is. We kind of take over the school.
Okay.
Yeah, we've got, you know, 20 different teachers teaching all kinds of art, from visual art, drawing and painting, sculpture, printmaking. We have cooking, and it's one of our most popular classes. We have one called Lotions and Potions, which is kind of chemistry and uh-huh. art all together. And, yeah, we have kids doing all sorts of things, of course, learning the ukulele.
Mm-hmm. And what are you directing or teaching?
I'm directing and teaching.
And what are some of the classes you're teaching?
I'm teaching ukulele. Uh-huh. Last year I also taught knitting, but I'm super excited this year that my assistant, Serena Partlow, took over my knitting class, and she's moved from being an assistant to being a teacher, which is one of the great things about this camp. It gives mm-hmm. young artists the opportunity to develop their skills as teaching artists.
Oh, I love that. And so you said 20 teachers.
Mm-hmm.
And about how many students do you have?
About 150 to 175.
Wow, this is a big deal.
It is a big deal, yeah. It's a lot of kids, and it's a lot of creative energy. It's really fun.
And you're saying, so you have good attendance right now.
We do, yeah.
But you do have room for more.
We do. We have room, especially in the grades 4 to 6. We've got room in 2 to 3 as well. Kindergarten is very robust, but we have some spaces there too. But I was noticing that, you know, in general, it's hard to find things for kids to do around town this time of year, so I just wanted people to know that we still have some room.
Yeah, it sounds like a lot of fun. You said cooking is one of the favorites?
It is. We have a pair of teachers that have been doing this for many years, and they make all sorts of amazing things like edible Play-Doh. And, yeah, and, rainbow-colored pancakes.
Is it savory or sweet?
It's peanut butter-flavored.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay, keep going, sorry.
Well, it's a really fun class. Everybody wants to be in cooking, it seems like. Yeah.
What are a couple of the other fun ones?
Diane Anderson teaches. She's been teaching for a long time, and she teaches both printmaking and sculpture, and kids mm-hmm. are actually getting to work with real soapstone materials and tools and sculpture, and then they're doing real printmaking with that, it's not linoleum, but it's that rubber stuff that you carve really easily. So I just think it's a wonderful experience for kids to get to use real artists' materials.
Yeah, absolutely. And how is it working? Are kids signing up for like 1 week, 2 weeks, by the day? How's all that go?
It's week long,
okay.
And many kids do multiple weeks. And the courses are designed so that, you know, it can accommodate a kid who's really interested in staying with a class, or they want to switch around and do different things from week to week. So you can kind of do it either way. In ukulele, we have new students that come every week, and we have some that stay for the whole month.
And it's a day camp, so mm-hmm. What are the hours?
The hours are 9 to 2:30,
okay.
And the kindergartners stay till noon, and then to second and third grade up through sixth grade, they can stay the full day, or they can do either morning or afternoon. It's their choice.
And what's the oldest kid that you have this
Entering
year?
Entering sixth grade.
Entering sixth grade.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And should they bring a lunch?
They do, yeah. So they all eat lunch in the auxiliary gym there in the
okay.
high school. And, of course, the kindergartners, they move on at lunchtime, but some of them have older siblings and their parents come and they sit around, and it's pretty social time at lunchtime down there.
What's been the most challenging part for you putting this all together?
I think it's, for me, I love directing the camp. I've just really enjoyed getting to know artists in the community
uh-huh.
And also the assistants, some just really engaged, excited young people.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard for me to switch my brain from directing to teaching in the morning when I'm greeting
right.
everyone and,
right.
you know, kind of having that hat on. But it's still fun. I enjoy it a lot.
And it sounds like maybe one of the most fulfilling parts is seeing some of your students become teachers.
Yeah, that's so great. So she's not the only one, Serena. We also have another teacher, our lotions and potions teacher. She used to be an assistant. And then Nicole Nelson, who is right now, she was an assistant last year, and she's assisting for the first 2 weeks in this show, in this class called Repurposed Fabrications, which is like turning old clothes into new things.
Mm-hmm.
And then the second 2 weeks of the month, she's going to be teaching the class, so that's pretty neat.
Okay. So if somebody's interested in getting involved with all of this, how should they do it?
Well, we are part of Juno Dance Theater, which is the dance studio here in town, and our website is, you can get to the Fine Arts Camp at junodance.org. So that's the easiest way to get information, and you can also call the Juno Dance office to enroll. You can enroll right online as well. And I did want to mention, too, that we have this amazing dance company that comes into town as part of Fine Arts Camp. They're called Weber Dance, and they're from Boston. And they do an evening workshop that goes alongside Fine Arts Camp, and they also offer two classes during the day at Fine Arts Camp itself.
Wow.
And for the evening participants, there's a performance coming up that I wanted to tell you about, and that's on Friday, June 20th at 7 p.m., and that's going to be at the Thunder Mountain High School Auditorium.
Okay, so everything for week three starts up on Monday.
That's
Monday
right.
morning.
Mm-hmm.
When would be a good time for a parent, say, to contact you and talk to you about all this?
So in the afternoons, if you're calling the studio, the best time to call is in the afternoon. And it's best to register by Friday of this week, but you can register up to the day of, up to Monday morning if you really need to make a last-minute decision. It's possible.
Well, it sounds like a lot of funny, or sounds like a lot of fun. Fun and funny stuff, too.
Yeah, for sure.
But, Amy, thank you so much for coming in today. Anything else you want to add about it?
No, I don't think so. I, you know, it's just really amazing to see the kids engaged and really energized by the art they're creating.
Well, thank you for doing that. It sounds like a great, great setup. So.
Great. Thanks
All
very
right.
much for having me.
You're welcome. See you, Amy.
Bye.
Someone you knew is true, good night. I got you on the mind. Heart that my love is gone, blue night, blue as I could be.
I'm Jordan Nigro, and I'm a sustaining member of K2. I have listened to K2 my entire life. I grew up in Gustavus, so I think I was listening to K2 in the womb. Becoming a member felt sort of like a rite of passage and becoming a member of the community. It's not about the amount, it's about the connection.
Connect and contribute at ktoo.org. You're listening to a Juno Afternoon here on Tuesday, June 10th, 2014. I'm your host, Scott Burton. Just heard a Hot Rise number right after our interview with Amy. Blue Night there, going into Charlie Hayden and Friends and the Hayden Triplets there with I Hear a Voice Calling. Hope you enjoyed those tunes. I have an announcement to let you know about, a second Friday reception at the City Museum. The Juno Douglas City Museum hosts a second Friday reception on June 13th from 4:30 to 7 p.m. After a month-long closure in May, the museum is pleased to welcome the public to a reception in honor of an exhibit entitled Outside My Window, featuring the work of local artists, many of whom will be in attendance. There is no charge for visitors beginning at 4:30 on Friday the 13th. So check that out. And to take out the show today, I pulled up a Mudrooms here from November, and it's titled Olivia. Let's take a listen.
Our next speaker tonight is Olivia Pitisha. Pitisha? Do you want to say it? There you go. Olivia tends to avoid the question, where are you from? Like all of us, she is here today as the result of thousands of stories. Although she is a dual citizen and has a heavy addiction to world travel, Olivia's love for the natural and cultural landscapes of Southeast Alaska grows daily. A liberal arts student focusing on the social sciences and art, she finds there aren't enough hours in the day to do all that she loves. You can usually find her working at the UAS Pottery Studio, climbing on the Mendenhall Glacier, or hanging out in the Tongass with her favorite plant, Devil's Club. Only catch her quickly. In a month, she's leaving for a salsa dancing festival in Colombia. Please welcome to the stage, Olivia.
When I first heard about Mudrooms last month, I became really excited because I didn't know it was happening in Juneau, and I feel so strongly about the sense of community that it creates. So I got online at like around midnight, the night before last month. I saw Scars, and I don't know what I was thinking, but I sent off an email because I have a really big scar on my face, and so somehow I thought that should qualify me to talk about Scars. But then the more I thought about my scar, I realized I don't have a fantastic story about it. You know, as a climber, I'd love to say, you know, yeah, dude, I was climbing on some gnarly ice and a chunk fell and slashed my face. But it wasn't such a good ego-boosting story, but I'll tell you about it nonetheless. My scar was basically the result of a random act of violence. Nothing too crazy, but I was in Cordova, Alaska at the time with my father and my sister. And my dad was working as a gillnet mender in Cordova. So my parents had already split up at that point. My dad had put in a lot of seasons fishing out in the Bering Sea, had met my mother in Bristol Bay. But he had also been a sailor in the old country because he immigrated from Yugoslavia and had actually gone to sailing as a way to get out of an orphanage in Sarajevo, Bosnia, where he spent a lot of his childhood. So, like I said in the intro, a lot of random stories brought us to Cordova, where we were at a little community event. It was just a picnic sort of concert thing, and some boy, I don't know his name or anything, but he just decided to knock me out with a rock. So it was not as extreme as it sounds. I just remember waking up covered in blood, and my father picked me up off of the ground, and we didn't have a car at that point. We used to have this beater truck. My sister and I would hold this rope that kept the driver's side door shut while my dad drove around. But at this point, we were on foot, and he picked me up, took me out into the street, and just walked right in front of a minivan, I remember, and stopped this woman's car. And I feel sorry for her. I wish I had her number. I'd call her, because not only did I bleed all over her passenger side, but, you know, my dad is kind of a scary dude. He's just a man's man, you know, old world Slav who went through a lot. And people ask me, you know, what's your dad like? And I think, you know, if I was teaching ESL and I had flashcards or something and it came to man, I think my dad would probably be on the back of that card, right? So he stops, her minivan, gets in, no hesitation, and says, "Woman, take us to hospital." And so she did. She took us to the emergency room. And I got all stitched up. And it wasn't that big of a deal other than, you know, it took us a few years to pay the bills off. And I got a lot of ridicule. But kids make fun of you for anything, right? So I'm at the point now where I'm happy I have my scar. But what's kind of ironic about me having this big scar on my face is that my sister does as well. Hers is larger than mine. It's right in the middle of her forehead. And she also got it in Cordova with my dad when my mom wasn't around. And that wasn't a violent act. It was just an accident. My dad would mend his nets in what we called the locker, which was a big hanger for storing gill nets up above. And they had lockers for fishermen and fisherwomen to rent to put their gear in. And he rigged this big rope and put knots in it. And it was probably 15 feet up. And, you know, it was right over sheer cement. And he would say, you know, whoever climbs to the top gets ice cream. And it was, you know, most parents wouldn't rig a rope right above a slab of sheer concrete, but we were kind of used to those sort of things. He would do things like build a fire in the front yard and say, you know, for us to jump over it, and then build it bigger and see who could jump over the biggest fire. And I still remember, I've actually inherited this skill. He can take those, you know, those Victorinox fishing knives with plastic handle and just rapid fire stab the spaces between our hands on the dinner table, which we always did. I'm actually, yeah, if you guys want to test my skills out sometime, let me know. But so we were used to these sort of things, and we had a lot of fun on that rope because we really entertained ourselves with nothing. My dad was kind of a radical, and we didn't have very many amenities. We lived a whole year in Cordova off of $2,000. So we were used to just kind of hanging out. And one thing we loved to do was twist up the rope, put our feet in it, and then let go, kind of holding it like this so that we could spin around. And I still remember my sister spinning, and she lost grip and fell and just slammed her forehead completely into the cement. And it split her face open in the shape of almost a perfect Y. The one leg is just a little shorter than the other. And I held the rope with for the beater truck that time as my dad drove us to the ER. And I remember her holding a shin guard against her forehead because we played so much football. That's the only thing we had around. And so we've, you know, grown up most of our lives with these really large scars on our faces, and I'd like to think they mean nothing to us. I can't speak for my sister. Obviously, we had to get over some confidence issues with them, but I think, like I said, and I'm at the point now where I like it, but unfortunately, we haven't been around each other so much to watch these scars fade, because shortly after these events, we were in Croatia for a summer holiday, and the war had ended, so we were going back now, but we were still based in Alaska. When my dad informed us that we weren't going to come back to Alaska and we were going to stay there and live with him while my mother lived in Alaska. So we were given this choice as pretty young children, and my sister said yes, and I decided to say no at around 7. And come back and live with my mother here. So ever since then, we've been very much a diaspora, my immediate family. And aside from, you know, a few years she's been here, I go over there a lot. But, we don't get to see each other very often. And I think it's interesting that we both have these scars, and they don't mean very much to us. We don't talk about them ever. We don't even notice them, I think, when we look in the mirror. But there are larger scars that we also don't talk about that run much deeper than our skin. So, thank you.
A well-told story there, that's for sure. I was just looking at the Mudrooms website, and it looks like their schedule is up for next year, and they're accepting speakers. You can find their website at mudrooms.org. Check out that fine event. Let's listen to the station ID.
This is KTOO Juno. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juneau and Douglas. We rebroadcast on translators K276 AF in the Mendenhall Valley and Auk Bay, K269 AO in Lemon and Schweitzer Creeks, K201 AM in Gustavus, K220 BT in Hoonah, and K210 AS in Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait. In Juneau, KTOO is on GCI Cable, on digital channel 871. We're also online at ktoo.org. Support for national programming on KTOO comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
Tomorrow on A Juno Afternoon, Ken Fix will be your host. We'll continue our Fish 101 series with Tyson Fick from the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute. Amanda Triplett will be here to highlight the best of UAS events. We'll talk with Kyle Wiley-Pickett about this weekend's Juno Symphony concerts. We'll hear an audio profile about the Children of All Nations dance group, that Writer's Almanac, Bird Note Music, and more Wednesday at 3 here on KTOO News. If you miss a Juno afternoon or want to listen again, you can catch it in other local, statewide, national, and international news at ktoo.org. The weather looks like tonight, partly cloudy in the morning, then becoming sunny, highs around 61. Tonight, mostly cloudy, scattered rain showers in the evening, patchy fog late, lows 42 to 48, light winds. Tomorrow, partly cloudy in the morning, then becoming sunny, highs around 61, west wind 10 miles per hour. Thursday, partly cloudy, highs around 60, southwest winds to 10 miles per hour. Friday, mostly cloudy, highs around 61. Friday and Saturday, it looks like rain, lows around 47, highs around 51. Thank you so much for tuning in to A Juno Afternoon here today, Tuesday, June 10th, 2014. Stay tuned for All Things Considered.